I am Michael, and I'm a gratefully recovering Al-Anon.
I am Michael.
Is the microphone still working?
Yes.
I'd like to ask you to join me in a moment of silence and concentrate on this Al-Anon's thought to live by. Any good that I can do, or any kindness that I can show to any fellow creature, let me do it now. Let me not defer or neglect it, for I shall not pass this way again. I am still Michael. And I am powerless over people, places, and things. That's why I'm an Al-Anon. It's another way of saying I'm a recovering control freak. I'm a recovering perfectionist. My daughter tells me I'm a control freak, so she must be right. So, just to correct a slight anomaly, my first meeting was in 1987, not 78. That's okay. This is saving the tuk tuk is 87. So I'm not that old. So I was born in 1953 in Ireland. When growing up in Ireland was pretty easy, you just had to do what the Catholic Church told you and everything would be fine. I was the middle child of five. The two older sisters, then I came along to terrorize my sisters, and then I had a younger brother. So the first four of us were born in 4.5 years, which was normal in Ireland in the 50s. My sister came along 9 years after I was born. She liberated me, because up to then, we were dealt with by our parents as the girls and the boys. And I was the senior boy, responsible for all the boys did or failed to do. So I was responsible for my younger brother, who I loved dearly, but I had to control him at an early age. If he fell and cut his knee, I was punished. At the age of 6, we were crossing the road together. He wouldn't come with me. I went across, and as he crossed, I said, "No, not now." And he was hit by an motorcycle, a mobilette, or whatever you want to call it nowadays. All he got was a tire mark on his leg. He had to go to hospital for a checkup, and I was hiding under the kitchen table when my dad was pretending that the police were at the door to take me away. So I quickly learned control mechanisms, how to control people, even when I loved, especially when I loved. Unfortunately, I had a very bad temper. I think I might still have. When my dear wife contacted the administration here in Holland to organize our wedding in 2001, she had to give her details, and then she gave my details. And when she said, "There's nationality," she said, "Irish." And the reply was, "Girl, do you know the temperament of these people?" She says that often and more often. So the program helps me, but I'm still a work in progress. So I had a fairly normal Catholic education. At the age of 7, I knew who God was. God made the world. God is my Father in heaven, the creator and Lord of all things. By the time I was 11, I knew all the different sins. I knew the sin of presumption, the foolish expectation of my salvation without using the means necessary to obtain it. As an 11-year-old, it was very good for my spelling. I could spell these words, and I had an idea what they meant. As I got older, when I was 16, we have an exam called the Intermediate Certificate, which is like O-levels, GCSEs, as they call them nowadays. I'm not sure what that equivalent is in Holland, but it's the first state exam I had to do. I did pretty well, 7 out of 7 honors. I went to see my father to tell him the news. He was looking at his roses in the rose garden. He just said, "Okay." I didn't know then, but he'd been diagnosed with cancer. So he was preoccupied with his fight to survive for his family. And in those days, in 1969, cancer was a death sentence. So he died when I was 18. And as his coffin went into the grave, a voice inside my head said, You're on your own now, Michael. Life is what you make of it. And I believe that voice. A year later, I joined the military because my mother, my widowed mother, couldn't afford Sandwich University. So they educated me, and they particularly put a lot of emphasis in the officer training school on command and control. So, as you can imagine, I rose rapidly through the ranks at the tender young age of 33. I was in command of a ship with 55 men to control. We were only men in those days, no ladies in the Navy then. So for a boy who had gone to a boys' national school, a Catholic boys' school, and was now in an all-boys military, I knew as much about women as I knew about nuclear physics, which I'm afraid of. I went to a birthday party, sort of as a gay crasher. It was basically anybody could go. I didn't know the guy, but he wanted to have lots of people at his party. And halfway through the evening, I saw this beautiful woman staggering through the door, being helped by her friend. And I looked and I said, "There." So I didn't say I saw it, and I was with a friend who also thought, "There goes a beautiful load of trouble. Stay away." 9 months later, we were married. She was 5 months pregnant. So this is now 1979, and this is how you did it in those days. Yes. There is a Chinese proverb, I think. It's not a program, but it says, for instant happiness, get drunk. For short-term happiness, get married. And for long-term happiness, keep a garden. But I was too busy trying to make my lady happy, trying to keep my family on the even keel. So I really couldn't do any gardening. But I got 2 out of 3. And we went to parties, and she was a great cook. She would prepare everything herself, and at the end of the party, she would be lying flat on the couch. And I remember once my mother saying, "Please thank her for this wonderful party. She must be exhausted after all her So I carried her to bed. And the next morning, when I was having a bad night's sleep worrying, she would hoover under the bed just to show me that she was fine. I basically loved going to sea. Going to sea was my escape. I love going to sea anyway. I love sailing. I grew up by the sea, but it was my escape. Everything was neat and tidy on my ship. And if my kids said to their mom, "Where is the nail scissors?" she'd say, "It's upstairs." And if it's not upstairs, it's downstairs. So that's how we lived. It came a time when I had to do a residential middle management course, which was going to last 9 months. And it was in the center of Ireland in an army training institution. So I was sent there for my sins. And before I went, I was preparing, and in the naval base near my home. And my wife was coming to collect me, and she came with 2 young kids in the car. She had been visiting her dad, who was making his own beer. This was the thing in those days. We couldn't afford to buy beer anymore, so we made our own. But it was only half made, and they'd been sampling it. So she was a little bit drunk, and I was embarrassed. I have to admit, I wasn't. I was upset that the kids were in the car, but I could see they were safe. But I was embarrassed because I had a colleague with me, and I'd offered him a lift home. So I drove home, I drove them, my wife and kids home, I drove him home, and we all were very polite, everybody pretended nothing happened. When I got home, dinner was ready. It was mincemeat with some vegetables and a bottle of wine. And I thought, this is perfect. I can now explain pure logically that the wine costs more than the entire family meal. And I started to explain logically, and of course, it's the worst thing you can do. Suddenly, the dinner was all over me, and she was running out the door. Disappeared into the night. It was pouring rain, and she had no raincoat. The kids were upset. I didn't know what to do. I couldn't run after her. I tried, but I had to come back. So then I started to ring, and I rang a friend who had suggested to me after that famous party when she left drunk that maybe I should ask her out. And I did. And I rang her and she said, no, she's not with me, Michael. But you know that she's got a drink problem. And I'm just so disgusted you've done nothing about it yet. So this was in keeping with the culture of the time. I was the man of the house. I was the father of the family. I was responsible for everything. I was responsible for my little brother when I was growing up. I was responsible for my ship and everything that was done or that failed to be done on that ship. And now I was responsible for something a little less, just a woman and three kids. Because by now I had three kids. So I decided maybe I need to find out how to stop her drinking, then everything will be fine. Now my sister was in Al-Anon, and she had been going to Al-Anon for a few years, and then her husband started with AA. So I thought, well, that's it. I go to Al-Anon, I learn how to do it, and then she goes to AA, and we all live happily ever after. So I went to my first meeting, and I was told, I don't really remember much about it. I can remember a lot of smiling and a lot of happiness, and people talking about their difficulties, which were far worse than mine. I remember a lady saying, my phone is cut off, so there's no point in calling me, and I'm not sure if I'll be leaving there next week because I might be evicted. But she was well-dressed and she was smiling. And I thought, wow. I remember a lady saying to me, we don't give advice, except six meetings. Give six meetings before you decide whether it's right for you or not. So in Ireland, there was no problem. Within a week, I had my six meetings done. And then I went off and did this course. Excuse me. So I was 9 months away, and I had a midweek Wednesday night meeting. It was great. I didn't have to make any excuses to where I was going. I just got the bus into the nearest town from the army barracks. But after a while, the guys in the course of me thought, there's something going on here. But they never said a word. One night, it was a pretty miserable wet night, and one of the ladies said, I'll drop you home. I said, no, I'll get the bus home. But it's okay, I drop you at the back entrance to the barracks. So she dropped me off at the back entrance, and as I got out of the car and turned to walk towards up the road to the barracks, one of my colleagues jogged by and said, hi, Mike. Later on, he came up to me in the bar and he said, well, you're all wondering what you're doing. You're a sailor. You've got a woman in town, haven't you? We only knew how many women I had in town. Because it was maybe 8 or 10 women, I was the only man. Which I've come to accept in Al-Anon. I did actually have a sponsor in my hometown in Cork who was a man. And also my sister was an Al-Anon sister and sort of sponsor because she knew me better than anybody and I couldn't bullshit her about my childhood or anything like that. So life was great for that time that I was away and I got a chance to get a job in Brussels. And a friend over there sent me the Bulletin, which is a magazine for expatriates. And they, in the Bulletin, they had an Al-Anon meeting. English-speaking Al-Anon was in Brussels, so I thought, I'm safe, I go there. So I went to work there in 1988. So at this stage, I'd been in Al-Anon 1 year. I got very busy with traveling, moving my family over, getting my kids into school, buying the duty-free car, then getting the duty-free fridge, and all these other things we're entitled to. Busy, 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 much too busy to go to Al-Anon. And after nearly a year, my eldest son, who was now 15, he's actually my stepson, he was 5 when I married his mum, he was having problems in school, he was having difficulties at home. I was away a lot, I was traveling 120 days a year away from home, which was much better than the Navy when I was 190 days a year away from home. And one evening, my son was completely disobedient. How dare he? So I told him to go to his room. He, halfway up the stairs, he came back and said, I'm not going to my room. So I grabbed him and I pushed him and he pushed me back. So I hit him, boink. But I hit him here, where it wouldn't be too much damage, I hope. But I hit him hard, as a man can do to a 15-year-old. And he went to his room and I thought, this has got to stop. I cannot control my son by physical violence. I need to make a commitment. Because I thought everything was fine at home. I had graduated from Al-Anon. She didn't seem to be drinking too much, even though the household bills were astonishingly high. So I decided to make such a commitment, I have to go to Al-Anon. That's serious stuff. You do serious stuff in Al-Anon, and that would be serious. Because I said to him, I'll never hit you again, son, and then I did. He would never trust me. I never actually did say, I will never hit you again, son, but I never hit him again. So I went back to my Al-Anon meeting in Russell's, and I started working the program properly this time. My big problem with steps 1, 2, and 3, and by the way, the 12 steps of AA are exactly the same as Al-Anon, except for the 12th step where we say to others instead of to alcoholics. So Al-Anon is for everybody, AA is just for alcoholics. So you're all welcome. Oh, I see a few balls. Please don't walk out yet. So I started working the steps, but my big problem was my Catholic education. Step 2, step 3. God, yeah. He sits on a throne, white beard, sees everything. And he knows me, exactly what I'm doing. And as a teenager, I really tried to be an atheist. I'm actually a failed atheist. Because I knew that when God got his hands on me, he was going to burn my ass. Because I had done a lot of bad stuff, including as an 11-year-old pulling my sister through the snow by the hair. I thankfully have been able to, because she was an Al-Anon, she understood when I went to see her and say, we've got to talk about this. And I saw the hurt in her face as we were talking about it. But we hugged, and our relationship strengthened even more. She has now passed away at the age of 50 with cancer, but I know that she's here now with me. So shortly after that, going to Al-Anon, Christmas came up. I'm not sure when I went back to Al-Anon. I think it was October 1989, roughly. What's that exactly when, I don't know. But by Christmas, we had Christmas Day. We went to visit some friends. There, all the Christmas dinner was prepared. And by the time we got home, she was very drunk. So myself and my eldest boy had to prepare the dinner. She went to the bathroom downstairs, and then decided to go upstairs, and halfway up she fell all the way back down. And next thing, she was in the pouring blood, into the car with the kids, drove to the nearest hospital. I had to park the car when they took her in, and by the time I got back, she was in the emergency room. She came out stitched up. I asked the doctor if he could, I thought the doctor might be able to say, yes, she's drunk, because then I could say to her, you fell down the stairs because you were drunk. When she sobered up, she said, we have to get a new carpet on the stairs. And I remember my two boys nodding, and my daughter was behind me saying, no, mommy, you were drunk. She hissed it out. She could see the reality. That's Christmas Day. We put her to bed. I said to the kids, it's okay, we'll have Christmas dinner now. We'll have another one when mommy wakes up. When she woke up, now I was long enough in the program to say, it's okay, dear, you're fine now, you've been patched up. And, you know, you probably had a few drinks too many, but it's okay now. Then, of course, in Brussels, it was hard for me to go out and pretend I was going to see friends, so I had to tell her I was going to Al-Anon. And that upset her because she thought, I'm now branding her as an alcoholic. I said, no, I'm going to Al-Anon for myself. I need to go. When I was in Ireland, she suspected I was seeing another woman because I'd come home, not smelly of drink, even though I'd pretend I was in a bar, but with a smile on my face, looking very relaxed. So, shortly after that, I heard through a friend that she was seeking a separation, and she told me. So, we separated in Brussels, and then she had to go back to Ireland. And to go back to Ireland, I had to pay for the furniture removal because I had felt I had a commitment. And it was a difficult time because I was bankrupt. We had no money to pay for her removal. I could have got further into debt, but the bank wouldn't allow me to do that without her signature, and she refused. So I decided I would go on a holiday in France with my kids. We went to a camping holiday. We borrowed the camping gear from a friend of mine. We drove down there, and we lived in southern France in a place called Beaumont-de-Lomagne, near Toulouse. And we lived for half the cost of living in Brussels for 3 weeks. We had a wonderful holiday. I had a plan. The plan was I had to go to Canada in September to work at sea, away out 300 miles to the east of Canada. And I thought, okay, I can just fall overboard. I have a good insurance. If it's an accident of work, my family will cater for it. All my debts will be paid. And I'm a failure anyway. So I thought I'd have a holiday with the kids so they'd have a good memory of me. Off we went camping, and each morning the kids would sleep on and I would go down by the lake, and I took my, at the time, ODAT, it's even more battered than my courage to change, no, but I brought it down and I just sat there and meditated on the reading and felt a oneness with nature. For the first time in my life, I could see the fish jumping in the lake. I could see the sun, and I'm trained as a navigator. I know the sun is precisely where it's supposed to be. That's probably, in those days you didn't have GPS. I could cross the Atlantic using a sextant. Sun and the stars, you can say they're going to be there, and they're exactly there, because it's nature has a mathematical precision, which can only be due to some power greater than myself. So by that lake, I discovered the power greater than myself. This was not the guy sitting on a throne with a long beard who's going to burn my ass. This was the God who shone on everybody, good, bad, and indifferent, and was shining on me now. I also had a bonding with my kids, and before we left the campsite, 3 weeks after we got there, my son insisted that we sign up, we register for the following year. That saved my life. My kids needed me, and I needed them. So we signed up for the following year, and we got in the cart, and it was the 1st of August 1990 now. And as I was leaving the campsite, I saw this guy reading the local newspaper, and it had one word in French, it's the same word as in English, which is pronounced a different, invasion, invasion. So I said, who's invading who now? Being an ex-military, I was interested in wars. And so I drove, and on the way up, I tuned into the radio, and France Inter, I don't know if anybody ever listened to France Inter, but there was a guy, and he was giving the latest update on this war. He sounded like his ass was on fire. He was speaking so quickly. But after a while, I figured out he was talking about Kuwait. My sister had just gone back to Kuwait after a month's holiday in Ireland with her three sons and her husband. She had arrived 24 hours before the war started. She woke up the next morning to find tanks trundling down the street and incommunicado with the rest of the world. So I rang my mother. My mother was completely going crazy with worry. Also my stepfather, because my mother remarried after her dad died, was now in hospital. And he was suffering from some infection of the heart muscle. And the doctors were struggling with him, and my mother was really struggling because it was deja vu. She had the same problem with my father. When she asked the doctors about my dad, they more or less said, well, he's gonna die, you know, he's got cancer. So she didn't want to ask the doctors about my stepfather. I needed to get to Ireland to help her, but I was broke. I struggled for a whole week. Instead of filing the report that I was supposed to file when I went back to work, I struggled for the whole week trying to figure out how to get to Ireland and gave up. That weekend, I went on Saturday after doing the housework in the morning, I decided I'd go for a swim. I went to the local pool, it was a beautiful August day, and we could lie out in the sun. So I lay out in the sun, and I was bored because I didn't bring a book. Everybody else was either chatting with their friends, listening to their Walkman, we had Walkman in those days, or reading books. So the following day, I went to church in the morning for a bit of, to talk to people, because we had coffee afterwards. Then I went home, I had my lunch, and at this stage I learned to set the table, put a little flower, invite myself to lunch, and sit down, no longer eating out of the pot, but eating from my plate. And even a glass of wine. I'm in Alamo, I got a glass of wine. And so I had my lunch, and then I decided I'd go to the swimming pool. So I went to the pool, and but before going, I said, I better bring a book. Now, I had been learning French from Lucky Luke and Tintin and these guys, but I was too embarrassed to read that in public, you know, grown man reading cartoons. And I found a book which my aunt had given me. It was a thin book. I couldn't focus on reading in those days. And it was called Sadhana, A Way to God, which is basically how to meditate using Eastern techniques for a Christian, because I'm a Christian. As I said, I'm a failed atheist. So I brought that book and I started to, after my swim, I lay back, which was having been in sea for so long, that's when I was at my most comfortable. Lay back and started to read and do the exercises. And I'd say probably, it threw me out anyway, the swimming pool had to close, so it was hours doing this. And I went home feeling like a kid when I was a kid with my new pair of shoes and my football, knowing that when I go home, Mum would have a cup of cocoa for me and then she'd put me to bed. I just felt carefree. All the worries that I had, this bowl of spaghetti of problems about my financial problems, my how I was going to get my family back to Ireland, all that was gone. The following morning, I finished the report. In the afternoon, I was asked to come to the director's office immediately. He wants to see all inspectors. I said, I'm the only inspector. Well, come immediately. So myself and Anne-Marie, who was a Belgian administrator and didn't travel very much, she came with me. We sat at this big, big table in the director's office. And he said, we have a problem. There's a ship waiting to go to Canada with two of your colleagues. All their luggage has disappeared in London. And we need somebody to go over there quick. They need their documents, they need a flag, they need et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. Can one of you do it? Anne-Marie looked at me. Why isn't Michael volunteering? Does he expect me to go? I was trying to stop myself, jumping over the director's table and kissing him. Because the ship was waiting in Cork, in Ireland. That night, I got on board. The captain summoned me his cabin. He said, Michael, nice to see you. Everything turned up when you were in London. We thought we could call you and send you back, but we thought you might like to keep coming. So that night, I sat with my mother with a cup of tea. The next day, I went to hospital. I saw my stepfather dying of anxiety. He said, these guys came to take blood off me. I asked them, what's it for? Now, these were hospital orderlies. They said, they didn't know. I told them to fuck off. Okay. On the way in, I saw this very attractive lady doctor who had been in the army, and her husband was an army officer. My stepfather was a retired army officer. I said, Barry, next day when all the doctors are doing the rounds, you'll see this attractive blonde lady. Talk to her and she should explain everything. Next day I brought my mom to see her. My mom couldn't drive, so she needed me to drive her. I brought her there and he was sitting up in bed. His lunch, which he refused to eat the day before, was now, all that was left was a soaked chicken bone. And he was smiling happily. And he said, she's wonderful, she told me everything, what they're doing, so it's, he knew what was happening. Following day, I went for a cup of coffee with a friend of mine who was a Mr. Fix-It. I said, I got this problem, it's going to cost me 4,000 euros equivalent, which is what, over $5,000 in 1990 to bring all my stuff back to Ireland. And I can't figure out how to do it. And we were mulling this over when a guy walked in, a friend of his, and he sat down with us. He worked for Bell Shipping. So, 500 euros later, a container was put outside the door. All I had to do was organize the packing and the insurance, which was done. So when I went back to Brussels, I had everything organized. I gave a file to my wife with two telephone numbers. I said, if you want this done, I'll pay for it, but you telephone this guy, you telephone this guy. And now it was 3 weeks had passed, so I could take the kids for a week's camping holiday again. On the way over in the plane, I was sitting beside this young lady and I had two bags. And I said, I insisted, I was, of course, last minute, so I was traveling business class. And I said to her, I got these bags. I told her my story and I said, I don't believe in coincidence. This is a divine coincidence. I had let go. I had done the third step at the swimming pool without realizing it. I am so stupid, but I couldn't do the third step until I did it without realizing it. And I didn't tell her that, but I told her there's this divine coincidence, and now I'm bringing these bags, and I refuse to put them in the luggage. I carry the two of them, one bag for me and one bag for the guys waiting for their gear. I think I'm running short of time. Am I running short of time? My watch has stopped.
You're good.
How many more minutes? Keep going. Well, it's 10 to 9. My watch hasn't stopped. No, it says 10 to 8. It's an Irish time. My watch is an Irish time. Sorry. So, I had done my third step. And I remember I used to say to my my sponsor at the time, a lady called Lisa. I said, Lisa, I have to do this fourth step, but I just can't seem to do it. She says, Mike, why don't you go back to the third step? I said, I've done that. But I hadn't done it. Now I had done it, and now I could do my fourth step. I did my fourth step, and then I had to do my fifth step with Lisa. That was difficult, but Lisa was a beautiful young woman, recently married, and but a woman of such a deep spirituality, it was just incredible. And I had to share, I wanted it, I shared some of the stuff, and I thought, I know there's some stuff I'll share it with. I go to a bus stop, and I just turn to a stranger, and I tell him, and then I go run away. Or something like that. I could ring up these, what do you call them, these helplines? Ring them up and just say, I'm doing my fifth step. Can you listen for a minute? Because I had one thing that I thought was unforgivable. I had been unfaithful to my wife during my marriage, and I had to share that. So I shared it with her and all the other stuff about stealing of motorbikes when I was a teenager, these other stuff, everything. I told her that. And then I expected her to throw me out. And she didn't. And afterwards I spoke to her again. I said, you know, I had to say all this stuff. She said, you know, Mike, it really helped me when you told me that stuff. Because her dad had split up from her mother because he had been unfaithful. And she said, now I can understand him better. So that's the beauty of the program. We think we're burdening somebody with our problems through the sponsorship or sharing. We're not. We're actually sharing something which helps the other person. I know now when a lot of people come to me, they think this guy's been so long in the program, he knows everything. So they share a lot of stuff with me. And then they say, I'm really sorry for dumping this on you. I actually feel a whole lot better just from listening. I am still trying to listen as best I can. My wife tells me I should listen more. And so I keep coming back. I did my dark secret in the fifth step. And I kept going. I managed to do all the way to the ninth step. Most important was my kids. And I thought, instead of saying to them, remember, I spoke to my daughter once about when she was hiding behind the door as her mother was hitting me with her belt. And I played rugby, so I knew how to protect myself. So I just said, this woman is smaller than me. She's not as strong as me. She'll eventually stop, and I'd be okay. So I just covered my vitals, and she hit me a lot. But I saw, looking through a chink in the door, my daughter watching, terrified. And I tried to talk her through, but she didn't want to remember that. So I realized that the best thing I could do was change my attitude to my kids, support them as best I can. The hardest decision I had to make was to stay in Brussels to get out of my debts and our debts, which were now mine. And there I had good program, I had good support. It was difficult. The most difficult time was when I rang my ex-wife. We were still separated because there was no divorce in Ireland. To make the arrangements as usual to pick up the kids, because I used to I used to take them for every half term. I insisted on that, and half the holidays, summer and Christmas. So I saw them every 6 weeks. Which my daughter said, "That's fine, Dad. When you're in the Navy, we only saw you every six weeks." And I remember ringing her, and she said to me, "You know that somebody else, my best friend, and her are an item, which means that they're going out together." In fact, he was living with her. And I said, "No." She told me that just as she was signing off. I said, "No, but thanks for telling me." And I put the phone down, and I collapsed in a heap. And I started to ring people on my phone list. And I finally found somebody, and she spoke to me, and she spoke along, and she said, ring me anytime, but no, I won't come over, I'm not coming over to give you a hug, you'll get through this. I spent probably the whole weekend on the couch, and I got over it. So then I had to collect the kids, and lo and behold, his car was parked outside the door. He was nowhere to be seen. I collected them, and I put them back, because they were still young. And I had the groceries collected, ready to move into the flat where we were staying. And as I was turning the car, I said, whoops, I better not bash into his car because that would be trouble. And I looked in the mirror and my son was like this. And looking at my daughter, Dad's going to explode and blow the roof off the car. What's going to happen? So I said, how are you getting on with him? And they said, oh, he's fine. He's fine. Sound. He's grand. In other words, change the subject. But they knew that I knew, and they knew that I had accepted it. I had to accept it. And I said to myself, you know, he was my best friend. He's a guy I trusted. I trusted him with my confidences when I was going through my separation, even though he was with her and I didn't know it. But he was a good guy, and I thought, well, if somebody else has got to sleep with your wife, it's best with your best friend. That's the positiveness of the program. So, I think with that, I have lots more to share, but I'm afraid you'll have to come back next year. And I'm sure I won't be asked to speak again. So I really thank you all for listening. Thank you all for the positiveness that you have been sending up to me, because I was so nervous and I didn't come here first. Thank you so much for listening.